you to please take your seats. Welcome to the final panel, closing panel of this conference. Delighted to have you here, and I thought what I would do is map out briefly what's ahead for the next hour and a half, which will go by quickly, I know. So for that reason, we've got some panelists here, and generally afterwards we're going to open it up for discussion. But the main purpose of this plenary is to surface some of the constructive ideas that arose first in the early breakout sessions from yesterday. We want to have each of our panelists talk briefly about the ideas. And then what I'm going to do is to ask from the audience some of the moderators who were part of the breakouts from earlier today, from this morning, and to add their ideas. How this will go forward is we will have a discussion about the breakouts and actually anything else that's been that's sort of on your mind as a result of this conference. The conference organizers will afterwards carefully review this discussion, and we will, as we did last year, frame some of the areas where we think there are consensus agreements, and we'll circulate those to you for comment. There may be things that we take forward as the World Forum on Governance. There may be other things that that make sense for other organizations to do. And we have a great example of exactly that sort of route. A template for that that we'll hear about in just one moment. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn to George Dallas first to start. George is, as you know, from FNC, and the reason why I'm asking him to go first is he's going to have to scoot out at 11:30 to carry forward exactly the work that was produced from the breakout session. So,
absolutely,
a good model.
Go okay, thank you, Stephen, and good morning, everyone. And this is true. We are, I think, at 11:30. Five of us are going to leave the room, not because we're bored, but because we have a meeting to go to. And in fact, there's two this afternoon. There's a group of us from the investment community: Phil Armstrong from the IFC, Amra Balich from BlackRock, Laura Berry from the Interfaith Center, Christian Strenger from DWS, and myself, which I think makes a pretty interesting group of investors, are going to be meeting at 12 o'clock today with the Deputy Minister of the Ministry of Trade and Industry and and one of the department chiefs on innovation within the ministry. And then at 2:30 today, we're meeting with a body called NERV, which, as best as I can tell, has its similar equivalent to the Council of Economic Advisors. And we're speaking with the people who run the secretariat there. So I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. But as Stephen said, this is not only an idea that was developed here in the past couple of days, but this is really something that took shape in the first World Forum on Governance, where the idea was to get institutional investors in a room with senior government officials to try to explain our own perspective on anti-corruption and business ethics, and to try to understand what the government is trying to achieve, and also to try to encourage them to try to do the right thing to fight anti-corruption, to promote business ethics, both as an end unto itself, but also I think that there's an enlightened self-interest that comes with this, and this is the message that we'd like to take. This meeting was actually convened not by the World Forum, but by the International Corporate Governance Network, where many of us attending are members. This represents $18 trillion in assets under management, and so hopefully we have a bit of clout in terms of talking about institutional investment and concerns that we have with some major institutions. this whole event over the past few days has been obviously focusing on promoting ethical behavior, fighting corruption in a unique format of public sector, private sector, civil society, media. And this is the part of the message that we're going to be taking, because I think it's not just investors acting unto themselves, but also trying to coordinate in a way that we haven't traditionally done, and for outcomes which I think hopefully are going to be positive. We have distributed, we have sent, and we will send again to these groups, and the ICGN's Statement and Guidance on Anti-Corruption Practices, Statement and Guidance on Political Lobbying and Donations. And it occurs to me, Stephen, it would probably be good to get some hard copies of the Prague Declaration to hand out, the 10 principles as well. I don't know if we could get that from...
Maybe our staff can do that, do you think?
Okay.
No, but for today's meetings.
For these meetings.
Extra copies.
And I think our point is going to be, we are investors, and our fiduciary responsibility is to provide investment services to our clients who are retail savers, who are pension funds, insurance companies, and the like. The point is that anti-corruption that we're going to make is yes, it's a moral issue, but it's a business case as well. It can affect how businesses perform. It can affect returns to investors. And I think from the perspective of governments, it can also influence national economies and society. And I think played poorly, it could be lose-lose-lose. Play positively, hopefully win-win-win. So what are we going to try to do? Well, when we sit down across the table, we have our cup of coffee and water. What do we say to these folks? And I think we're trying to, first of all, we're trying to convey a message, but I think we have to listen too, because just talking without listening, I think, is not a way to be particularly effective. And we also need to appreciate the fact that when we're talking about bribery and corruption and poor ethics, this is a very sensitive topic. So I think it's not as if you can come in, pounding a shoe on a table. I think we need to appreciate the sensitivity here and really try to express the fact that we do think anti-corruption is bad for business, but also the fact that good governance can, for the purposes of the Czech Republic or any other country, can and should be a source of comparative advantage. And I think that is a key point which can lead, at the end of the day, to capital flows, both from institutional investors who buy securities and stock exchanges, but also for foreign direct investors who are arguably in this part of the world are even more meaningful in writing big checks to set up plants, manufacturing operations, create jobs, and that sort of thing. So I think that I think the point is to emphasize that this can and should be a race to the top as opposed to a race to the bottom. The business case is both looking at individual companies as well as the market as a whole. And I think we're beginning to see that this is, for individual companies that are on the wrong side of anti-corruption, this can be a substantial risk. We've talked a lot about the Siemens case, which is really one of the big recent ones, but I think there can and possibly will be others that result in similar amounts of fines, similar amounts of legal fees, management disruption, blacklists from contracts, licenses to operate, and effectively the potential to do what we don't want to see as investors, which is the potential to disrupt sustainable earnings stream, which is what we're looking for. I think we also, apart from looking at individual companies, need to think in systemically in terms of just the market as a whole. And here, I think the evidence, I think this is more difficult to measure, but probably just as real, if not more so, in terms of how anti-corruption can distort markets and competition. It effectively creates leaks to the system, providing rewards to people who should not receive them. And ultimately, economically, I think the answer is that it hurts cost of capital. That'll be higher, reflecting the risks. And the problem is that if a company is trying to do the right thing in a country which has a reputation for anti-corruption, there's a problem of being tarred with the same brush. And I think that's something that we need to try to encourage governments to recognize, that we need to raise the whole system to a level that makes sense and is attractive to investors. Norm was very helpful in coaching us in terms of how do we get off to the right track in a conversation. And again, we're not going to go slamming our shoe on the table. And I think we do need to recognize that the Czech Republic has done many good things. It's a well-managed economy. The levels of debt are low. They have a good credit rating. But I think what is also true is that investors, through their own risk modeling, we're doing this at FNC, we're starting to pay more attention to country risk indicators as part of our looking at and part of our evaluation of country opportunities. It could be the Corruption Perceptions Index, rule of law indicators, regulatory quality. All of these are imperfect, but it's a starting point. And I think the fact that we and others are beginning to put these into models for country risk, I think is something potentially a piece of information that would be interesting for them. I think that there are issues that the Czech Republic needs to think about. There was a recent Visegrad study of the Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, where they showed that, amongst other things, I think the Czech Republic and these countries perhaps rate better in many cases than other emerging markets or some of the other transition economies. But I think it's still, if you compare them with more developed economies, there's still a ways to go. And I think that this country certainly, I think, can and should aspire towards putting itself in the ranks of developed nations. I think it has a lot of the basic building blocks to that. And so I think we need to express this positively as an opportunity and to try to ensure that the right things are being done. And I think the point that we need to make is to try to promote political will to address these issues. Again, the argument is at once moral, but it's also economic at the end of the day. Specific points that came up in our discussion about the Czech Republic, which I think we need to address perhaps delicately, but I think that we shouldn't hold back from them. I think the Czech Republic has scored poorly in comparative studies looking at law enforcement. I think that there is a legal framework in place, but how effective is that legal framework in practice? And in fact, this Visegrad study quoted about the Czech Republic saying, an adequate legal framework does not necessarily provide sufficient protection against doubtful behaviors. Imported rules from outside can be simply empty shells. So we need to talk about how enforcement can be real, provide support for the prosecutors, provide them resources to let them do the job well. An issue that I don't know how sensitive it is, but it was brought up in the conversation, was about having an independent judiciary free from political interference, which is another point that was referenced in the Visegrad report. A more specific point, which I think is also very relevant, is the Czech Republic is a bit of an outlier in the context of not having ratified the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, and that is the foundation for building a legal framework which I think can take things forward in a positive way. And the other questions that we may want to raise are, how can the Czech Republic, perhaps starting with its Visegrad neighbors, begin to develop dialogue with one another? Nasser, you made the point about an investor relations bureau, but I think we said we don't necessarily advocate that, but maybe we should ask the government if it has any ombudsman or any sort of framework for dealing with concerns for foreign investors into a country, just as potentially an idea to put in their head. And again, I think at the end of the day, I think we need to be positive. We need to recognize some realities, but I think that the point is that this is an opportunity for the Czech Republic, if they want to tackle this issue with potentially some short-term pain, can create something that can build a competitive long-term advantage, which I think, at the end of the day, will bring in capital, both from institutional investors and from foreign direct investors. So that's effectively the message, and I will welcome any feedback on the script that we've just given. And I guess the last point I would like to make is that we are trying to turn this framework into a document, which would obviously, we're going to be focusing on the Czech Republic today, but to the extent that this concept proves useful, I think having this as a bit of a skeleton to apply towards other markets where we may be looking to do something similar. I know Sandra was talking about Brazil maybe the next stop for this, and so we can try to build a framework that we can use, whether it's the same individuals or not. We can be at least delivering a consistent message.
Yeah, and I what we're going to do is open, once we get through these things, we'll open it up for discussion. But I think I heard that there was a sort of a robust discussion in the breakout. This is, in a way, a good model for the global forum on governance, where we incubate an idea and then perhaps take it for an appropriate organization takes it forward. So, and in this case, it's the collective voice of capital, making itself heard in respect of anti-corruption. So, thank you, George, and we'll hope to have more discussion about that later. Can I ask Russin now to tell us a bit about the media breakout? And media is obviously an important, or should be an important, safeguard, watchdog on corruption. And we had a breakout that was specifically aimed at trying to find ways, encourage ideas for ways to protect media.
I would like to start with just to mention a study that Nobel laureate Amartya Sen made recently that revealed that in countries where there's free media, there was never been a famine. And that's why, because the famine often is not because of lack of food, but because of lack of information.
Sorry, could you maybe speak up just a bit in case...
If we could handle famine with free media, so we could tackle the corruption as well. We all agree that journalism has changed the last years. Not because we live in digital era, but because the financial crisis. And the investigative reporting, which reveals corruption, has paid a price because it's very expensive. You could never be sure in the result. So we realize that we have to take measures in order to optimize the investigative reporting. So we thought that it's a very good idea to create some kind of international network, some kind of even social network between journalists all over the world who could share information and resources regarding corruption cases. And just after the breakout session, we had lunch with Kenan and with Claudio. And Claudio was working on an Italian company. And he had some raw data, financial data. And he realized, and it happened here on the table, that he had some information about Azeri officials. So he passed it to Kenan. That's a good example how it could work. Such a platform could be very useful for exchanging good practices. For example, practices of crowdsourcing. Kenan shared some thoughts about how he could make the readers and the listeners to his radio reporters and to create watchdogs among them. And this is very important too. And finally, with Attila, we agreed that a very big problem is the lack of transparency regarding the ownership of the media. You cannot trust the media if you don't know who is behind it. So maybe it's a good idea on international level to create a legal framework that obliges to reveal the real owners of the media. That's a very big problem in Central and Eastern Europe.
Thank you, Russ. And so just to boil those, there are three ideas, constructive ideas that I'm hearing from you. One is the idea of a sort of a social media network platform for media to share information. Another is maybe best practices on a legal framework for disclosure of ownership. I also think that there were some media toolkits that have surfaced that maybe just making sure that those get circulated better would be useful. Yeah?
Yeah, it's regarding the training of journalists.
Training, yeah. Mm. Great. Thank you. And again, we'll save up comments on all these because they're terrific. Can I ask Nina to give us... Nina Gross was in the session on legislation
yes,
and anti-corruption law. Go ahead.
And I'm going to try to reflect everyone's comments and our takeaways, though we did not really have that many takeaways. I'll turn to others who were in the session for their comments and suggestions also. The overriding comment on the legislative panel was that we need to learn from each other, whether we live in or work within a context of a robust anti-corruption regime or where there's a country that's just beginning to develop its anti-corruption regime. And one idea that came out of this was similar to the media suggestion, was an international network of prosecutors, regulators, and the judiciary that at least for a transitional period of time could help both countries that are developing anti-corruption frameworks and those that have robust frameworks in working through a series of issues and then helping the private sector also understand its obligations. We talked about a quandary often about how to define a foreign official, how to define a benefit or a gift, what's in the public protection. And having such a network of individuals that can be a resource for others could really help flesh out some of these issues. Issues around what's an independent judiciary or prosecutor, and does that mean if it's independent, sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Is that prosecutor also impartial? Should there be separate anti-corruption prosecutor offices, or should that be left to the general prosecutor? The second, I think, overriding comment was about the public procurement rules. We focus a lot on anti-corruption laws and regimes, but public procurement has as much to do with corrupt behavior as anti-corruption laws do. And we need to scrutinize those rules and create, again, a code of some sort or some general guidelines on what a procurement process should look like to make sure it's transparent and above board. Similarly, Ruth Marcus made a very, very good comment about the importance of disclosure regimes, similar to the media comment, trying to understand and have a more transparent process around knowing what beneficial ownership is for various entities. We deal too much with shell companies and not knowing who the ultimate owners are. In many countries that we often deal with as multinational companies, you can't get into the corporate records. You're concerned about violating bank secrecy laws or corporate secrecy laws. And so how do local laws that may conflict with anti-corruption laws, how do we work through those issues to find some common agreement about how to create a regime that's not just anti-corruption but also transactional law focused that takes the two together? And lastly, we discussed we want to actually, you know, we have the FCPA, the UK Anti-Bribery Act, the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, the UN Convention Against Bribery. Should we have an international code against corruption that takes all these laws and puts into a much simpler format? And can this fora, this network, help create that so that we look at corruption as, or being free of corruption, as a human right? And is that something that the forum can actually look into? Tom, did I forget anything?
And I think, thank you, Nina. And I think we also, you and I talked about this concept of maybe a contact group of, because you've got, there's a potential for sharing information on current law, but it may be that there are other jurisdictions that are thinking about crafting law and perhaps having a contact group of officials or authorities in different markets, right, that already have law. Yeah.
The network of prosecutors and legislators and judges who can be resources and you can bounce ideas off of, not just on the larger framework of laws, but the more practical issues of you know, how do you conduct due diligence if the information is not out there.
Great.
You can require companies to conduct due diligence on their supply chain, but if you don't have the information available, it's not helpful. So getting people together, having that network to share ideas and bounce issues back and forth.
All right. Thank you, Nina. Those are also wonderful, thought-provoking ideas. And can I finally, at least in term, not finally, but in terms of the breakouts, turn to Catherine Marshall to talk a bit about the civil society and faith-based breakout.
We focus mainly on the faith-religious dimension. Civil society is, in a sense, something else. And the reason is that the sense is that religious and faith institutions, individuals, and ideas should be major allies in the struggle against corruption and for good governance. And yet they're not to the degree that one would expect and that they should be. The reason they should be allies, even though it may not seem that way in Prague or New York or Washington, it's still a very religious world where some 85% of people would answer that their religion is a very important factor. And in survey after survey, whether it's the Latino Barometer or Philippine Weather Station or whatever, when you ask which leaders are most respected, religious leaders are most commonly either first or second, way ahead of government officials, police, NGOs, etc. Plus, a lot of the ethical language and values that many people hold implicitly or explicitly have very religious roots. So those are the reasons that one would expect to see the religious institutions and ideas very much part of the anti-corruption movement. And yet, there are some very courageous religious leaders who've been the most outspoken and who are speak truth to power. And yet, when you go to most of the anti-corruption events, you look at the integrity networks, there are really very few religious leaders, very few religious voices. And so the question is why. So I think the first thing one has to do is to try to answer that question. Part of it is that there is a discomfort, even about the definitions of integrity, between religious and secular institutions, particularly on the civil society side and in many government institutions. And that was visible here also. There were some doubts here as to whether religion should be given any pride of place, whether it should be treated in any fashion separately or distinctly. And there's a long history of why that is. So I think we need to remember that this is not a unanimous nor a simple thing. There are doubts in many religious institutions about the motivations of secular institutions and vice versa. There also has been something of a lack of sharing of toolkits of actual. There's been a huge progress in thinking about strategies against corruption, governance issues, et cetera. And not much of that has been transmitted. I was actually at a meeting of IFAPA in Johannesburg a few weeks ago, which was talking about the roles of religious institutions in free and fair elections. But it was a rather difficult conversation because you had a very limited number of people who were really experts, but most people had no idea even how to confront the issue. So in terms of actions, you asked me for three, I'm afraid I have six. But I think my first comment is that in dealing with the world of religion, which is huge, complicated, controversial, anything that's done needs to be thoughtful, it needs to be informed, and it needs to be careful. There is no such thing as the faith sector. We are talking about several thousand years of history, hundreds of thousands of different institutions, different traditions, different ideas, and so that should never be left very far aside. But I think the first point that came out of our discussions was the idea of framing the case for anti-corruption in terms that encompasses both the macro and the micro, mega corruption and petty corruption, the impact on the poor, that should never be forgotten, and that the technical framing and the financial justifications for fighting corruption need to be balanced with the ethical and the moral, dealing with some of the issues of values, which was an issue that came up in various parts of this discussion. The second is that there is a lot of outreach that can be done to specific institutions. The first that comes to mind is Transparency International, which is actually going through a reflection itself as to why its faith partnerships have been so weak over the years. But TI is very open and interested, and we actually have a March deadline for trying to do something. The next major international anti-corruption conference will be in Tunisia in 2014, which means that there's a specific point at which some of the issues are, that come out of the Islamic world will be on the table. There is also, I think, merit in reaching out to the big interfaith organizations, particularly Religions for Peace, but also the Interfaith Youth Corps and a few others, which have never really taken on this issue, and nor has the community of Sant'Egidio, which has an annual meeting which discusses every global issue under the sun. They've been skittish about dealing with corruption, but trying to press them to do that. The ICCR, Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, Laura Berry, of course, was our able representative, has a 40-year track record of dealing with the corporate, the financial power of religious institutions. So the outreach, the second point is outreach to some of the logical fellow travelers. Third idea that we had was that it would be worthwhile to support a thoughtful reflection by some thinkers from different religious traditions about modern concepts of good governance and corruption that could frame some of the discussions in language and in terminology that would be more moving, more inspirational to people who come not from a financial background, but who come more from the ethical and the religious perspective. There's room for training and development of practical toolkits. For example, sort of bribe payer index is better understanding of how anti-corruption programs can actually work. I think there's a need. We've started some at the Berkeley Center at Georgetown of trying to do mapping of what people are actually doing, what institutions are doing that have some religious inspiration, but we've only scratched the surface. And finally, it's easy to forget that the religious world has huge media outlets. And they're both traditional media, radio, press, but also vast social media. One person I track just by chance, because I've met him, is Amr Khalid. I think his Facebook fans are now at 4.5 million. So, and that's just one person. So there's a huge potential in thinking consciously about media from that direction.
Thank you, Catherine. And actually, at the risk of making it seven, one of the other issues that came up, I know of, it's very hard to figure out the way forward, is that the institutions themselves may need to be more reflective on their own governance. Mm-hmm. Religious institutions have to figure out legitimacy in terms of their own governance and accountability and transparency. So that's, I'm not sure quite how we do that, but that's something that institutional investors are facing too. You have to have standing, in effect, to make the argument against corruption. And the first way to do that is to make sure your own house is in order. So that's a tough one.
Transparency is not always an easy.
No, and it's not a right. It's not culturally something that a lot of institutions are comfortable with.
There's gender equity, shall we mention?
That's right, Jan. That's right. We've asked Gitesh Bansal also to join this panel. He made heroic efforts because of visa issues and flight issues to get to this conference from Bangalore, and we had him originally on the first opening panel, but obviously he was unable to make it, but did come in midday yesterday. And of course, Gitesh is from a group called IPaidABribe.org in India, and it is really the civil society piece of this puzzle. So we've just asked him to make a few remarks. We wanted to make sure he had sort of airtime in a plenary session because it's such an important and innovative approach to the anti-corruption piece. And it also gets to the issue of battling corruption from the ground up. So if you wouldn't mind, make it. Thank you. The floor is yours.
So In terms of tackling corruption, and today we, during the plenary session and during the breakout session also, we were discussing how there are various tools available. One of them is I paid a bribe and not in my country. How these tools can be spread across the world. Right now, we use ipaidabribe.com. It was started in India. We were approached by about 25 countries to launch similar initiative in their own country. And we have already launched it in Kenya and Greece with participation from NGOs and people from civil society in those countries. So, like today, during the breakout session, the ambassador also mentioned that civil society is the third leg of the stool. It is political, it is business, and then it's the civil society. All these three have to work together to ensure whatever changes, whatever procedures are in place to tackle corruption are systemic, are long-term, and are sustainable. So, having said that, one of the concerns which actually came up in the session was, how do you protect someone? How do you protect whistleblowers, for example? And there were thoughts on, should we even tell them that we will protect you because we are incapable of doing that? So that was a very interesting thought, because if the state is not able to promise security and safety to its citizens who are helping fight the corruption within the businesses, within the society, then whatever we talk about anti-corruption, does it even hold ground? And another thing is, in the absence of that, how do you engage the users? How do you engage people in bringing out, in coming out of their home and doing whatever it takes to tackle corruption? We all know social media is a great medium. Facebook itself alone has more than 1 billion users. But then some of you would say, what about the rest 5 billion? How do you reach out to them? What if we don't have internet penetration? What if people don't have access to internet? Then the point comes, when you're reaching out to this 1 billion, you are giving them information, you are empowering them on by saying, hey, these are the things which are happening, and this is the way in which you can make a difference. There would be some opinion leaders in these 1 billion. There would be some people who would connect to the masses who are not able to access internet. And then all of them, with all this information in their hand, can work with the government, within themselves, to put out ways and means to tackle corruption. In India, I would just take this specific example of Anna Hazare. If I'm not sure how many of you would have heard about him. He started one movement around 2 years back by saying, we want one ombudsman bill. And it was a civic movement. Government initially, they agreed to it, saying that, okay, yes, we will, let's have discussions, let's sit across the table and talk it out. Then they delayed it just to take the steam out of the movement. Then the group, which the civil society group which was, they themselves had some doubts on what is the right way to proceed. Should it be only the movement, or should you give an alternative to the government? Should you launch your own political party? So they have actually launched one political party, saying whatever we do, the anti-corruption movement, it should be viable and it should be visible. If none of these are there, then the whole movement fails, because citizens are not able to connect with you and they're not able to take they're not able to understand the gravity of the situation, and they're not able to act. And in the absence of any action from the citizen, the democracy as a whole fails. So, yep, that's all I say.
Thank you, Bansal. And Gitesh was really talking about was the breakout that we just had on civil society, and ipaytobribe.org is one of the important new players in that. So I encourage you to speak with Gitesh before he goes. I'd like to ask very briefly three, like for 1 minute each, if you wouldn't mind, and then we'll open to discussion. Three people, Sandra, Gira, and Judge Rolfe, I haven't talked to you about this, but it's probably not the worst surprise you've ever got, if you wouldn't just also give us an idea about your session, just, you know, whatever constructive ideas that came out, and Trevor Potter on the money in politics. So, Sandra, just if you'd stand up and wait for Mike. It's coming your way. Thanks.
Well,
and yours was the business integrity. Yeah.
Business integrity, right. We end our session with Norman reporting a disease, which is the post-conference inaction disorder. It was not a disease, it's a disorder. So we are trying to respond to that disorder. So the idea is that, first, there would be the need of have a convener at markets. So if a company have an issue that cannot deal itself with it, have a convener to, you know, address this sort of actions. And about action, we are talking about the need of collective action in the markets. And I think that we can summarize the rest of our ideas with the proposition of having a program being developed from this conference. So in order that addressing the disorder, that we really take action, and we have a follow-up, we are going to follow up, the idea is to follow up the actions of this program. So how, there were excellent ideas on how to build integrity in business. So this program would be about having the list and having a program and follow up these ideas. Anything else? The group in my panel? I think this is it.
Thank you, Sandra. I'm sure it was much richer than the few moments that you had. So, but thank you so much. Judge Wolf.
We did anticipate the possibility of this request and wanted
I
to come up with some concrete recommendations. And essentially, there are three points that we focused on. One, many countries seem not to have some of the legal tools that are necessary or the full range of them to combat corruption. And perhaps the forum could generate the development of a model code of provisions that a country's laws would have if it wanted to have an anti-corruption effort. Whistleblower statutes. For example, in Romania, the statute of limitations, in contrast to the United States, keeps running after you're charged. So essentially, the cases don't end in the courts. You know, you have a statute of limitations that stops at a particular point, and it could be even broader. Libel law is very important. In Slovakia, it's easy for public officials to win defamation judgments against public officials. In the United States, it's virtually impossible. Some of this, Dimitri will tell us, already exists, but it may not be that well known. Perhaps put together a sort of list with specific provisions. Second, many countries have wonderful laws, but they don't have the will or the capacity to enforce them. For example, to pursue money laundering. So can the international community do more to strengthen the capacity of individual people in various countries? Last year, as a result of a conversation Ambassador Sedgwick and I had with Daniel Lipschitz, who was here, the Minister of Interior in Slovakia at the time, said, if there's one thing that would help you, what would that be? He said, training in
how to investigate money laundering, and the Department of Justice sent people to Slovakia. But perhaps there ought to be even more of a group, and a better known group, because I believe it exists, NASA would say, in the IMF and at the UN, that will help people in individual countries. And third, very common theme of this forum has been that corruption is global and transnational. For example, it was emphasized with regard to the banks yesterday. And it occurred to me, beginning when I was here last year, that we should either strengthen or create new international structures, conceivably including an international criminal corruption court, or make it part of the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. David Luna is shaking his head already. It's utterly impractical. But if you think about the issues that prompted the development of the International Criminal Court, you have a culture of corruption. It starts at the top. There's a culture of impunity. The people who could improve the national efforts to combat corruption have the most incentive not to do it. All of these countries virtually are signatories to certain positive law, UN Convention Against Corruption, the WTO conventions. And while they would argue it's an incursion on national sovereignty, would they rather be prosecuted in Brooklyn by the United States or subject to some multilateral institution? With the idea of complementarity, if they really made the effort and demonstrated the will and the capacity to investigate and prosecute corruption in appropriate cases, they would not be subject to international jurisdiction. That's not the immediate answer to anything. The first two might provide more promise, but for things that could be made part of a conversation that's apparently occurring, although not found in the literature, we discuss that too.
Thank you, George Wolf. And actually, it might be worth surfacing at this point the idea that I think Matt Murray raised in a session earlier about whether corruption should be sort of elevated to a fundamental human right.
Well, you know, in fact, when he said that, I pulled up on my iPad the Declaration of Human Rights, which essentially internationally codifies our Bill of Rights and then also has social rights, but there's not one in there. And it's many of the individuals, free speech, freedom of religion, but not the general right to good government, which, of course, is not expressed in the United States Constitution either. I had to explain Skilling's and honest services fraud to Matthew, having instructed the jury on it. I hope I did it right.
Yeah. Although the U.S. Constitution does guarantee happiness, so I think, right? So, or is that the Declaration?
It's actually a significant distinction. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, yeah, sorry.
Constitution's much more procedural.
I stand corrected. No happiness.
Unfortunately, there's a big difference between the right to the pursuit of happiness and
happiness. Okay. Speaking of happiness, Trevor Potter, Money and Politics, right?
Yes, the difference between the Declaration and the Constitution in the States is, of course, the difference between aspiration and guarantees. And our session spent a lot of time agreeing on aspirations for campaign finance. We generally agreed that the subjects that all of us democracies faced in terms of money and politics included, first of all, disclosure as a fundamental foundation of any system of the money that is being spent to influence elections, whether it is directly to candidates or sources of funding for parties, or is being spent by others to influence the election outcome. That in addition to that, the question of whether there would be some sort of independent agency that reports, that political entities report to and which discloses the spending and which has an enforcement role in ensuring that limits are adhered to and disclosure occurs, whether there should be, can be, such an independent system, an outside agency, was a subject of considerable discussion. I'd say the state of play at the moment is, in the United States, we have such an agency, but it is functioning very badly because of a partisan deadlock. In most of the European countries we spoke of, it does not exist. The one shining light at the moment in this entire area in Europe was described as Poland, which has full public funding of parties and a independent enforcement agency and disclosure. It got there because of a major scandal in party financing, which is indeed the American experience as well, that we have had reform developments following major scandals, which may lead to the question of whether we should welcome scandals as the way of advancing. But disclosure, independent enforcement, the question of public financing, should there be public financing to enable candidates who are not themselves wealthy or not the candidates of a political party funded by wealthy interests engage in the political process? This is a question that was raised from Thailand, but it's obviously a question that affects all of our democracies. In the United States, we have seen the demise of our public funding system for presidential campaigns in this last cycle. And none except Poland, none of the European countries have sufficient public funding to do that. The point was made that there is an important role to be played by private funding as well. Certainly in the U.S. system, any public funding system has to be voluntary, so you will always have, under our Constitution, a role for private money. And the argument was made that that role can be constructive, not only in the U.S., but in Europe, where there is less of a tradition of what I would call ideological or altruistic giving of private funds, and instead there's much more of a quid pro quo system or heritage where companies in particular give money because they are expecting a particular contract or return. But we had a discussion of the idea of private financing to get something from government versus the situation in some of the European countries now where the political parties are financed in a non-disclosed way, essentially through government funding, either as part of contracts or undisclosed discounts. One, I think, productive thing that came out of the session was the comparison on discounts, the fact that existing U.S. law would say that if a commercial discount is given to a political party, that is at a minimum disclosable and at the federal level probably not permitted if it's below market rates, but that that would be an example of a way of at least disclosing funding for parties that could be useful elsewhere. I think we ended in terms of going forward by agreeing that the problem for all of us is getting our political systems to make these changes, but that the first and most important change is to find ways to disclose what is happening, because that leads to potential structural changes in the rest of the financing regime.
Thank you very much, Trevor. I'm sure you, like me, are sort of so impressed by the sort of richness of the ideas that have been put forward. But can we now open it up to discussion? I know George has to go, so let's wish him good luck and his committee. And you've got copies of the Prague Declaration to take with you. All right, good. Yes.
$14 trillion.
I know. That's right.
George, one thing you need to know: the UNCAC passed the Czech Senate yesterday.
Oh,
sure, it's a coincidence that the 100 of us are here. working on that for 2 years. So it still has to go through the parliament, through the lower house.
All right.
So we can
very nice news. Very nice news.
Excellent.
All right, and thank you, George, for your help.
See you.
Can we now open it up to discussion? I'm going to first, Saad, if you could get microphones. We've got just a quick housekeeping. We've got about a half hour of open discussion, and then Tom Coyne, and then Nasser. I think it's on.
It's on. Yeah. I actually have a question for Gitesh, who spoke about the Indian anti-corruption movement, which has really been the central political story of the last 2 years. One of the things that's emerged in India over the past 2 years is a deep-rooted cynicism about both government and politics. You see that in the media, you see that in social media, the sense that the system is completely broken because of the depth, the extent of corruption that now exists. One of the things that I find interesting about your organization is that you choose to effectively work with government to address this issue. So I have a two-part question. The first is, from your perch, how accurate or inaccurate is the broader discourse, both in the national and international media, about the extent of corruption and the extent to which the government is part of the problem? And secondly, which elements of government? Are there particular parties? Are there particular kinds of officials? Are they civil servants? Are they politicians? Does it vary very dramatically from state to state? So what are the lessons that you have drawn from this anti-corruption movement from your perch?
Before you answer, Gitesh, what I'd like to do is to do the approach that we've had throughout the conference, which is let's get comments and questions from the audience, and then at the end we can have some responses from panels. But I would encourage you not just to, I mean, if you have questions, you're more than welcome, but also make some comments about ideas and things that have surfaced here. So Tom, Nasser, and then Laura and Mustafa.
I want to ask about a totally different subject. It seems like there's a lot of consensus in this room and among the international community about what countries need to do to combat corruption. We've talked about regulation, disclosure, enforcement, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like a lot of the problems arise at the implementation at the local level, and specifically in enforcement. And one problem we see in Russia, and I think it's common to a lot of countries, is they do prosecute corrupt government officials. The problem is that the prosecutions are themselves corruptly motivated, not because the person is corrupt, but because somebody wants to get rid of him or take over his business or a combination of all of the above. And I guess my question to everyone is, how do we evaluate those kind of cases? Do we view them as positive because the government is taking measures to get rid of corrupt government officials, or negative because the system is being used for personal purposes, or is it a wash? And I just would be interested in people's thoughts on that subject.
Thank you. Nasser.
Just a couple of very practical suggestions. The role of the media. One thing I've noticed, particularly in many developing countries, is that the media and the journalists don't have the adequate economic and financial training to deal with corruption cases, where you might need to understand the financial transaction, how it happened, look at the balance sheet and all the rest. So I think one of the important things, practical things that could be done, is to provide economic and financial training to journalists. And perhaps we as a group might have some resources we could put at our disposal. We've got an important support group from any of the big four. IMF, World Bank could play a role in doing that. So I think economic training, financial training of journalists and media is something extremely important. You cannot really report on corruption if you don't understand and if you don't go through the forensics. That's one suggestion. The other one is on business integrity. United Nations has something called the Pearl Initiative. The Pearl Initiative is meant to be introducing good corporate governance practices, transparency and disclosure, as the name Pearl might suggest. So there is already an initiative out there, and one thing that can be done is to encourage businesses to participate in that UN-led initiative for greater transparency and disclosure.
Thank you, Nasser. I think actually Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to bring the
to bring in our discussion the issue of whether corruption or anti-corruption works pay in the political field, because in our panel we were discussing of how you need an important political player to pick up on the anti-corruption agenda. What we see in Romania, unfortunately, is that voters are going to vote against people that are promoting anti-corruption measures. And that is very disturbing to me. And I you know, it may be that in some other countries it works differently, but for us, mayors are very important. When you start anti-corruption work, you're going to pick on mayors because they have a lot of access to resources and they give it to their friends, families, and, you know, related companies. And then we've been yelling and screaming as part of the civil society and the media that parties should not defend their own people when the people are under investigation in the prosecution or before courts, okay? And we have two main approaches. One side, the right wing, doesn't protect them, don't go out in public, congregations to support their leaders who are investigated. And on the other side, we have the left, the governing coalition, who makes a protest every time someone is being investigated. And they go there with senators and ministers and, important people to defend the guy who took a bribe and was arrested by a judge. The sad thing of life is that those on the left are probably going to win, because mayors are saying, why should I stand in this party that doesn't defend me when I'm investigated? Why should I not move to the other party who is going to protect me, who promises to dehead the justice system, who promises that I will be protected and I can continue to conduct my unlawful businesses? So, that's just what happens in my country, and I think it happens in many countries when you see important people fall. You know, so how do we go about that? I mean, it is easier for someone external, like ambassadors or representatives of the EU or of the United States or UN to speak about these issues. But unfortunately, when you don't have a highly educated society that knows what rule of law is and what democracy should be, that society can be easily manipulated so that it helps the corrupt officials rather than the correct ones.
Thank you, Laura. Yes, Mustafa, and then David.
So one thread, I think, generally, which was like mentioned a bit on the panel, also this convener, I think it needs digging more into what type is it, always civil society, it's government, is it ambassadors, politicians, what would be the best tool for this? So we agree that it's a complex multi-stakeholder approach where you need to create sort of a win-win collective action. I think it's this vision came out of the session, but the questioning of the type of conveners who need to have this independence but still interdependent, what would be the best platforms, the best tools, and how they can have their independent resources, because at the end of the day, usually, how can you create independent conveners without having them interdependent, or sort of maybe portfolio finance or something where you have like different parties putting the money from the different entities, but the money itself is independent or something? Because if you're funded by a government, it differs if you're funded by donations, if you're funded by political parties. So I think this subject needs more digging into the best platform to create this multinational companies, local, governmental, civil society, communication, and collective action.
Thank you. David, Luna? Okay. Yeah, Lanny, and then. Okay, Tuli. No, first, David. Oh, sorry. He got the mic first, did he? Okay, all right.
Sorry, David. Going to the comment about our friend from Romania, I think what the conference can do is that we can think in the big picture, but we can be also very practical in the individual setting. So when I was in Romania, and there we have a very active ambassador as well, and Mark Gittenstein, I'm a little worried now about what the result was, but about a year and a half ago, your public prosecutor who prosecutes public corruption was getting a lot of opposition. And so as a result of that, when I went to Romania at the request of the ambassador, I met with him. The next day, some of his opponents said that they were now going to investigate him for corruption. So what we did was, while we were in Romania, and was really at the request of the ambassador, was that I made myself available to one of your largest publications, as did the ambassador, and we dealt with that issue front and center, and we said we didn't want to intervene in a domestic situation, but we were very shocked that this fellow, who really was, we thought, quite innovative and quite thoughtful and progressive, was being targeted. My sense at the time was that gave him, at least for a while, some real leeway to continue to doing what he was doing, and he was unbowed. And so my point isn't just talk about that example, but it's really through that level of communication where our ambassador literally said, you need to be available to the press immediately. And talking with this prosecutor, we thought that there was a real advantage. And so that's just a technique that I think a group like this can continue to employ.
So international support, really, for domestic
yes, and
good guys.
And public-private dialogue, yeah, with the press and the government, all of the themes we've been talking about.
Yeah. Very good. David.
Yeah.
And then Thule. And then Thule afterwards.
Yeah, I just wanted to build a little bit, I think, on what Lanny was emphasizing. There have been a lot of good ideas, and kudos to the organizers and all the participants. My office is in some ways uniquely positioned to address a lot of these issues globally. We're very active in every fora, the G8, G20, OECD, UNCAC, all the regional initiatives, not only on anti-corruption, but money laundering and other. A lot of these ideas have been explored in many fora, and some are more realistic than others. And I don't mean to dampen the good judge ideas. I mean, usually when we explore those type of ideas, we go with Lenny's lawyers from OIA and legal advisors, because putting aside the whole political foreign policy considerations, there are very much complex legal and constitutional issues, not only for the United States, but for other member states. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't pursue those type of ideas, but there are other fora that are similarly exploring. So as you begin a process of moving forward, I would try to distill, I think, some of the more realistic ideas that this fora can do, because, again, there are other places for example, these networks of prosecutors. They're being done in the OECD. They're being done in the UNCAC. I won't go into some of the other good ideas. But, again, the value, I think, of this fora is truly the public-private partnership and the linkage between anti-corruption and corporate governance. You mentioned that this can be a place for an incubation of ideas. I think Mr. Dell is there, and bringing the institutional investors and being a voice is something that is not necessarily being done in other fora. So again, I would strategically figure out and coordinate with other initiatives to see whether you're duplicating or not, and then harness really the energy of this group in ways that can have an impact, perhaps starting in this part of the world and then exporting those very good best practices and ideas to other parts of the world. Thank you,
David. And I think you're right, George's, and that whole initiative was a good model for us. Thule, and then Lenny and Melissa. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you, Stephen. Just a question, or firstly, maybe before I ask a question, to express my gratitude for the opportunity to participate in this forum. It has been a rewarding opportunity, and the insights from colleagues from all over the world have been quite remarkable. I'm interested in models for strengthening synergies within the countries themselves. I see here we such a diverse group in terms of who does what. There's civil society, there's people in government, there are judges, or at least I saw one judge, and people in government. That's a wonderful grouping. I'm interested in whether there are models, though, for having similar groupings in the country themselves, Because in South Africa, that's what we've been trying to build in the last 3 years. We have a group that is now calling itself a Good Governance Forum, and that's why we were attracted to this event. We started 3 years ago. Initially, it was a Public Protector Good Governance Forum, but eventually, we now have it as a National Good Governance Forum. And the thinking behind the forum was to strengthen synergies between the agencies and bodies that play some role in oversight on public accountability, particularly in the area of governance, including ethics and anti-corruption. And in the group, we've also brought parliamentarians from the ethics committees and public accounts committee, and we've brought the media, the religious community. But in terms of agenda setting, that's where I'm looking for models then from other countries, if there are similar groupings. What kind of agenda do you have, and how do you really strengthen these synergies? For example, we are in administrative oversight body. In this room, you have principally prosecutors. And in our case, the enforcement of anti-corruption laws is split between different agencies, including oversight bodies such as ours. And our quest is to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks simply because we have these different silos. That's just all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tuli, and we were honored that you were able to come as well. It was Eleni, Ambassador.
Thank you so much. Well, this has just been a great couple of days, and I've been so impressed with the thinking and with the experiences of the people in the room and the organizations that are involved, and of course, Norm, your leadership in pulling all this together for the second year. And I would just say that going forward, it's really important to recognize that we've been at some of these things for a long time, and the recent economic downturn has been a setback in a lot of places. And that looking forward, it would be really helpful, I think, to focus on the fact that there are a lot more tools at our disposal as a result of technology. And I really appreciate you being here, and I've heard about your organization, the work you're doing in India, and it's great. And there's a lot more of that going on. And that there really is an opportunity because of technology to really examine new approaches to dealing with this age-old problem. So as I said, I found this extremely valuable, and I think that there are all the makings for advancement. But putting at the core of it the new technology that's available and what the implications of that mean for really affecting change in the future, I think would be the takeaway that I have from this.
That's great, and I think we tried that in at an early stage here, and I think Gitesh was one. I also want to point out on that exact topic, we have William Jackson here from notinmycountry.org as well, and that's been an important player in Uganda, again, pioneering social media on anti-corruption. Melissa.
Of you for the opportunity to be here and to learn from you. It's been a wonderful experience. I just wanted to pick up on the idea that Catherine mentioned about ensuring that we do what we can to have religious groups play a more leading role in this area, and wanted to touch on an idea that we discussed in our group, and that is religious groups oftentimes are very invested in a variety of public issues. It can be climate change, poverty, sex trafficking, peace. And so going to them and asking them to add this issue, corruption and transparency issues, as a freestanding issue will probably be a harder sale than trying to develop resources for these groups and showing them how the lack of transparency and corruption are affecting issues they're already working on, like poverty or sex trafficking or climate change. And so I'm not sure which entity would be the best entity to produce those kind of resources. But I think as we do outreach and go to religious gatherings and engage religious leaders and ask them to take more of a leading role on these issues, if we come armed with talking points that will show them the linkage between activities that their constituencies and churches and denominations have already designated as priorities for them, and show them the linkage between these things, I think it will make a big difference in terms of getting their buy-in and their participation and leadership in this area.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I think we have time for maybe one more question, and then I'm going to ask the panel to make any reactions, and then ask our co-directors to come on up. Any other? Am I missing any question? Last comment. All right. If not, any of you have comments or responses to the question?
To the question regarding the corrupted, motivated corruption actions. I could speak by my point of view. In Bulgaria, there are a lot of police operations that are corruptly motivated, and its company rate, it's quite popular. Unfortunately, more than 80% of the media in Bulgaria are state-controlled, unofficially. So you could never reveal this to the public. I mean, my media outlet publishes article about it, but we're really boutique media with not a lot of readers in the masses. I mean, our readers are the executives, and most of the society could not understand that those actions are not okay. And regarding the financial reporting training, I'm into the judiciary reporting, but I have colleagues that are financial reporters, which maybe could be interested in this. Thank you.
Well, actually, on that point, I think Phil Armstrong's Global Corporate Governance Forum does have a media... you've done it too, so... Yeah, we need to expand that.
And
yeah.
It could be expanded.
Expanded, yeah, fair enough. Catherine, did you have any?
Reinforcing Melissa's point, talking about corruption is a very unpleasant subject in most cases. It's a sort of brutish and rather dirty subject, but it needs, therefore, I think, in narratives for anything, to be situated in a positive framework of what can be achieved. And one of the unfortunate things now is that it's not easy to find success stories. I'm trying to develop case studies for my students, and you've got Singapore, and then you've got a few other tentatives. So I think we need some more case success stories, both at the country level, but also at the sector, or something substantial. So I think that framing the issue much more broadly in terms of what we're trying to achieve is always important. I think that there is a real missing link for many groups in that's fed by cynicism about corruption and fed by the fact that I think the networks don't always work as well as they should in terms of what does work. So this question of positive case studies and stories, whether they're technology-led or whether they are people-led, because there are turnarounds. There are very important turnaround stories, and they're not known. And what the tools are that are involved is not as well known as it should be. And I find that particularly within the groups I work with, the sort of religious civil society, but I think it's much has broader applicability.
Great. Thank you, Catherine. Nina, what... Any takeaways that you'd like to share?
This has been, I think, a fabulous couple of days. And I'm listening to everything I heard the past couple of days and today. And it seems to me that there might be two paths here, or two work streams. On the one hand, there are societies or regimes like the United States and the UK that have very robust anti-corruption programs, laws, compliance programs that companies are trying to incorporate and make part of their business operation. The other workstream are those regimes that are beginning to create anti-corruption approaches, and they have issues around are there independent judiciaries, are there issues around disclosure laws, are there bank secrecy laws or employment laws that make compliance with anti-corruption programs very, very difficult. Do we maybe divide our work going forward into two different working groups? One that focuses on the emerging markets and all the challenges that are faced there and the resources they need and the role of the media and faith and other things, and then focus on the existing marketplace that's trying to do the right thing, but the actual practical problems of operating in fill in the marketplace. The recent FCPA guidance by the DOJ and SEC was a tremendous step forward for U.S. and multinational companies, I think, giving them some real understanding of some very practical issues. If we can take that and make that more global, so that companies understand if I'm in Czechoslovakia or I'm in Romania, I'm in the Congo, I'm in China, I have these issues, how do I grapple with it? How do I get information on my third party in China when there are no corporate records I can access and the bank secrecy laws are affecting me as to what I can access? If I'm in the Congo and my goods are held up in customs, what do I do about that? Who can I go to for help? And yet if I'm Romania or Czechoslovakia or Indonesia and I'm trying to build an anti-corruption regime, what do I need to do that? So that's my commentary.
Thank you. Thank you, Nina. And Kitesh, you get the last word.
So I'll just like to respond to what you asked on the prosecution which is happening. So is that positive or is that seen as negative? For citizens, as a citizen, I would see that as positive because I would see that all these corrupt practices, all these corrupt acts are coming out in the open. Now I know who is doing what. It could be in the current regime. The government is acting against opposition. Tomorrow when the regime changes, they will act against them. But as a citizen, I know, because they are both bringing out each other's secrets in open, so I know that, yes, this is what is happening. And with the power of media, it is much more easier to get that information and then see what is it that I would like to do with that information. And so I personally would see that as a positive. And like Nina said, I would just like to put that in a nutshell. There is no single solution to tackle corruption. Mm-hmm. It has to be contextual. What is required in Malaysia, in Egypt, in Uganda, in India, or in any other country would not be same because all these countries are at different levels of development. All these countries have different needs. All these countries have different ways to tackle corruption, and all these countries have different types of corruption which are coming up. So it has to be contextual. And I will just like to take one example here. Because if it's not contextual, it will only create more problems. If the solution is not contextual, it will only create more problems. It's like in Gods Must Be Crazy, they get an empty bottle of Coke, and it creates havoc in their tribe because they don't know how to handle that, what to do with that. So that's what I feel. It has to be contextual, but the common line here is there has to be a structure in place. There has to be political will with citizen participation and support from the business leaders to arrive at whatever solution that you are trying to propose to fight corruption.
Thank you, Gitesh. There's probably no better set of words for us to send us off. So can I thank my panel, first of all? We're delighted to have you. And then can I ask them to leave the stage? I know, such politeness here. Hospitality. And then can I ask my beloved co-directors, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein, and our philosopher king, Ambassador Norm Eisen, please, to join us. This has been a conference of equals, but great equals, so thank you. I think, go ahead.
First, let me join in thanking everybody for coming. This has been a really rich forum, I think, for all of us. Different from the last one in many ways. It's expanded our horizons. The number of sessions where comments from the floor, I think, caused all of us to rethink things and look at in a different way. We have a challenge emerging from this that emerges from all of our sessions. The first time around, we moved on through our declaration. We do not want, this is something that would be anathema to Norm Eisen especially, to have a forum for a forum's sake. Everybody comes, has an interesting time, and then goes back, maybe comes back a year later, or moves on to other conferences. We are very much action-oriented, we are particularly pleased that the declaration has, which involved an enormous amount of effort, both emerging from last year's World Forum, but also interaction that moved on, it's resonated in different places and it's had an impact. Where we go from here becomes another important phenomenon. At the same time, our goal from the first World Forum, and it continues, is to try and build a larger community, a network of people across different countries. It is all contextual, but we can learn from each other, gain examples, but also build alliances and allegiances. There may be instances where people have legal troubles, where colleagues that they've met or others that they know may be able to find pro bono legal support. We can build this network of support from important opinion leaders like our ambassadors and others who can speak up and gain a public platform in a way that individual activists simply are unable to achieve. And we want to try and build a broader and more robust social network amongst ourselves and expand it a little bit with others so that we can share those things. And we need to try and work through ways of doing that. And we would also love to get your feedback in terms of what subjects or what areas we might want to pursue in future world forums.
Well, I'd like, first of all, on behalf of Brookings, to express my thanks for all of you making this commitment and participating in such a lively and informative way. Frankly, it's something Brookings can be very proud to be the sponsor of and to be closely associated with. I was struck by David's comment, and I think it really is important to think of our comparative advantage. And I honestly believe it's twofold. It's one, linking the public and the private, and using the leverage of corporate governance and institutional investors to really make some breakthroughs in the problems of good governance and anti-corruption, and that has to be central to whatever ongoing efforts we might have. But the second thing is we actually invite and get the participation of people who are deeply involved in these activities, that are close to the ground, that have conveyed to those of us who are somewhat more distant and operating at a more theoretical, conceptual level with the practical dimensions of what the obstacles are and what the opportunities are. So we've got a lot of thinking to do. I think this has been an excellent forum, a different from the first, but at least as valuable. But as Norm said, Norm the Elder, that is, Ornstein.
Kings, you're the wise.
All the implications for me that entails.
You know, we really have to
check
to think through what set of activities would make the most sense. What we can bring to this effort. What might transpire in between gatherings like this. It's not obvious. The funding for such an effort is uncertain. I want to say at this point to express our appreciation to the BACLA nonprofit organizations, to Deloitte, to create.org, and Ernst & Young for their support for this gathering. But we really need to think through how we build on this. We're not going to have another declaration. We have our principles. We've picked up scores of ideas of things that would be useful, and now the trick is to figure out just how we do that. We'd welcome any additional thoughts you have, but we'll be in communication with one another in the days and weeks ahead to figure out where we go from here.
Well, we would be in communication with one another anyhow, just to gossip, and so it's nice that we have a pro-social reason. The some final reflections, as starting with thank yous. I echo all of the appreciation that my colleagues up here have articulated. Thank you to Brookings, to the wonderful staff of Brookings, to all of you, particularly to Roth, who I don't see because she's probably out wrangling.
Rafaela, stand up, Roth. She pulled this thing. Yes. Yeah.
So, really superb support from Brookings. Great thanks to our three co-directors, to Tom, to Stephen, to Norm. You really have put together, I think, an even better show this time around. So thank you. Thank you for that. To Mr. Bacala, who I sat with last night at the White Lily Award and filled in on all the wonderful things that have happened and talked about future activities. So he's a tremendous fan. To Zaro Streno and also staff, Mr. Pecha Lutzier, who is here. To Tomasz Klavania, who's very much a guiding force. Tomasz is over there. To Ernst & Young, to Deloitte, and above all, to all of you, including my embassy colleagues. Secretary Clinton has made public-private partnerships a signature of her time at the State Department. She's very intent on her dialogue, our dialogue, United States government dialogue with civil society in one of the three critical areas within that dialogue, and this was one of the inspirations as we, the four of us, talked about doing this the first time and certainly the second time, is on the subject of anti-corruption. Gratitude also needs to be expressed to the State Department. Having exhausted myself with thanking everyone, and above all of you, because you've made it such a vibrant, diverse, interesting, so much value added over the first one, I think. I did want to close on a couple points. I believe that the secret sauce of our event, to echo Tom, is the combination of political and corporate governance gurus. This is the only place where that happens. There are many wonderful existing initiatives on anti-corruption, and it's critical not to duplicate them. We're fortunate that UNODC is represented here, and of course the State Department in the person of Dr. David Luna is active in all of these events. I think it is fitting that as we speak here now, one of the outcomes of last year's World Forum on Governance, the roadshow, the actual engagement, trillions of dollars represented of institutional investors are at the Ministry of Industry and Trade actually engaging on these issues and test driving, piloting how that would work. And they'll have a meeting in the Prime Minister's office as well. So that's very promising. A second second initial takeaway, and I, by the way, anybody who doesn't have my card, I also offer myself since I was pretty engaged on fielding the hundreds, if not over 1,000 emails that went back and forth on the declaration. Stephen and I really took the pen on the declaration. I hope folks will include me in your thoughts about what you'd like, where you'd like to see us go next. I do believe that one of the things that came out of this is the lack of, there's a tremendous amount of action in the corruption sphere, but the scholarship, the evidentiary work, there's much more that can be done in that realm, particularly, I think, to make the case to business that this should be primary. It actually will enhance, will drive the bottom line if you deal with corruption in a more fundamental way. We talked about that in our session this morning, and I talked about the lessons from my many years of working both principally defending, but occasionally also fomenting financial and political scandals. The governance lessons that I took with me to the White House and the way I exploded the governance, the typical governance paradigm in what we set up in the White House, which has produced the most, the political scientists tell us, one of the most scandal-free administrations in U.S. presidential history. So I think there is a tremendous need for research, and there's been some conversations already starting about how we build on the work that's been done already. We look at what needs to be done, and consortiums as they exist in the social sciences and in the hard sciences, multi-university, multi-sector consortiums. We happen to have some very distinguished political scientists who are with us. So that's one thing that can be done. And then the question I thought also came out of one of the breakout sessions I floated. The question of how we move from, and Sandra already quoted me, how we move from a post-conference inaction syndrome to something more enduring. And I think the place to do that is in this question of engagement with business. But that should... That cutting edge of what we want to do, I personally think, needs to continue to involve all four legs of the stool, government, media, the NGO world, and business and labor themselves, all of whom are represented here, as we focus in that area. And Christian has agreed to help us start thinking about how we can. The only way you do that is by really organizing. You make a list, you assign tasks, and then you meet every few weeks, you have a regular meeting by phone or in person, and you check your progress. So I think we are going to do that, at least in that area of engagement, or at least Christian and I and others are going to try to do that. So those are some reflections and some appreciations of gratitude. I know it's been a wonderful conference for me, and I hope it has been for everyone.
Is there any other business before the... before us?
I have one. I just wanted to make, first of all, to thank both Anne and Jen and Christine, because they also came a long way to help with this conference.
You're here.
Make sure they get acknowledged. And then I just had one heartfelt comment to make, which is that everyone can check out by 1:30 at the front desk if they're checking out today.
The tears are rolling down my face, Stephen.
Yeah, I hate to be so emotional. But and the second thing is, if your flight is later in the day, the front desk can hold their luggage following checkout. So, all right.
Did I? Lunch in the restaurant.
And also lunch in the restaurant.
And let me make one final coda to what Stephen has said that applies to all of your participation in the World Forum on Governance. And that is that you can check out today, but you can never leave.
That's it.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.